I didn't ask Ann where she learned her Chinese.
Okay, open up the House Committee on Education for April 3rd, 2015. The order that we're going to be doing today is we're going to be doing House Bill 3180, then 3126, public hearing on 3363, and then work sessions on 2597 and 3039. Okay, so with that, I open up a public hearing on House Bill 3180. Richard, if you can read it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3180, buried in my packet, allows the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to use monies in National Board Certification Fund to assist candidates with expenses related to attaining the certification through the National Board for Professional Teaching Standards.
Okay, Representative Kopp.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. Thank you, and I appreciate you holding the hearing on House Bill 3180. For the record, I'm State Representative Betty Comp, representing House District 22, which is Woodburn, Jervis, and North Salem. I am pleased to urge you to have your support of a bill that would allocate funds to the Teacher Standards and Practice Commission for the use of teachers to gain their National Board certification. This is a two-year program that is has high standards, and it's rigorous. This program is costly, and our current teacher salaries, they can't really afford to these expenses related to this attaining to this certification. The National Board for Professional Teaching Standards promotes the enrichment of high rigorous standards for certifying experienced teachers. Because I believe they require a teacher to have at least 3 years, 3 to 5 years of teaching experience before they can get into this program. It provides a platform to renew commitment to student learning. The national data is clear. Teachers who complete the program have a 97% success rate with their students. What that means is this success rate is based on the fact that students receive the equivalent of 1 month additional learning as compared to their non-certified teachers that they're working with. This impact is even greater for minority and low-income students. With Oregon having one of the shortest school days of the year, I just think this is really important. Currently, the state has 313 teachers that have this certification. Right now, 51 teachers are currently in the process of earning this national certification. I learned about this program several years ago through NCSL, the National State Legislative Council. We are far behind Washington State. They have 8,196 teachers that have this classification. House Bill 3180 would reaffirm our commitment to our teachers by allocating $100,000 to this fund to provide 50 teachers each year to apply for grant to enroll and complete this two-year program. Higher standards for teaching means better outcomes and learning for our students. I would appreciate if you have any questions or your thoughts. Like this is a program I learned about 4 to 6 years ago, and the statistics, particularly for our low-income and poverty students, was remarkable. It was really remarkable. And I did not find the actual full cost for the, it wasn't quite $3,000, mm-hmm. so that we could attempt to get at least 50 teachers every year started. And then also I think in the bill you'll find that if they teach in an underrepresented district that is a focus school, then they would be allowed to that would be the other half of a mm-hmm. grant, so mm-hmm. they wouldn't have to pay that back.
Okay, great. Any questions of Representative Comp? Okay, actually, this is a very good program because the National Board Certification's been around for quite a long time.
Right.
And it is very rigorous. And so the friends of mine that have gone, at least some have started the program and did not have the time to get through it. But it is, you literally almost are a master teacher when you finish this program. So it's a very, very good program.
Well,
but it is expensive, and we no longer have things like we used to back in the olden days, things like tuition reimbursement for further education. Now it comes out of the educator's pockets.
Well, and the other statistic, Chair Doherty and committee, is that even just having one or two of these teachers in your school, and they immediately almost start mentoring, or they become a go-to teacher, and people go, well, how'd you do that lesson? Mm-hmm. And so it's something that just kind of naturally bubbles up and becomes, a real positive program in schools.
It is. Okay. Representative McLean.
As far as the, I understand who's going to be, covering the funds, and
It's us, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right, and then I also understand the administration. What was the, I couldn't find the criteria for how those 50 candidates were going to be actually chosen.
And thank Chair Doherty and Representative McLean. What the intent is that through rulemaking in the teacher standards and practices, that they would develop the criteria.
Okay, I wanted to simply say that I would hope that there would be some guidance or some amendment that would provide that guidance that would indicate that we want to make sure it's equally distributed through the state or through districts, because it feels like, if all the resources always go to one type of school, then it feels like other people don't have the same, mm-hmm. Opportunities. And so I would hope that there would be some guidance there for the
rulemaking. Vicki Chamberlain's here from head of TSPC, and she'll be able to hopefully answer that question.
Well, and Representative McLean, if I missed it in the bill, I can easily do a quick amendment to put it in.
I'm very supportive, understand.
Right.
Madam Chair, members of the record, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of TSPC. Representative McLean and committee members, we have some experience administering these monies. For a short amount of time, we had a grant that we were able to dispense out, and then the national boards matched it. And it worked quite well for us to just take people first in line, first in time, who applied for them. So we got the word out through OEA, mm-hmm. That the funds were available. So half of their cost of national boards was paid by national funds, and the other half we were able to match. And we just did that until we ran out of money. So how I see, because the individuals who apply for this are putting in a whole lot of work, mm-hmm. and yeah. Almost nobody applies who isn't really committed to getting it done. So we would just let it be known the funds are available, and then as they come in the door, dispense them until we run out.
Okay, well, as long as it's getting out to everybody, that's a good thing.
Okay, great. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair and committee.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Okay, with that, I close the is there anybody else that'd like to speak on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I close public hearing on House Bill 3180 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3126.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3126 establishes minimum education requirements for high school teachers of dual credit courses. It takes effect July 1st, 2016, and staff has uploaded onto OLIS some relevant materials from the Accelerated Learning Committee, which did work over the past interim.
Okay, thank you. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Evans, House District 20, which includes Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem, and Western Oregon University thereof. I noticed a bunch of folks from Western here today, so I wanted to say that. House Bill 3126 has already provoked a conversation. I think I've seen some of the folks from some of the universities and colleges more in the last 5 or 6 days than I've seen in the last 2 years. So mission accomplished from that perspective. What it does and what it was designed to do is set a requirement or a criteria for people that are giving or at least involved in providing collegiate level credit at the same levels that used to be standardized, at least relatively standardized throughout the state. So here's what I mean by that. When I first started teaching college courses in the 90s, and I've taught consistently 100 and 200 level courses at universities and colleges throughout the valley since then, with the exception of when I had to go fight wars from time to time, the requirements to teach on your own were 27 credits in a content area, at least in my specialties. Sometimes 24, sometimes 20, depending on where you went. But an understanding that above a bachelor's level, there needed to be content area expertise. And I understand over the last several years, for all the right reasons, we've tried to extend the opportunities for folks that are going to K-12, or at least the K-12 age cohorts, with opportunities for getting collegiate level experience so they have a head start, or at least compared to other states, can try to catch up. And I think that a lot of that work has been very laudable. However, my concern is twofold. Number one, I think in some cases, especially in the era of open borders and increasing pressures upon the K-12 faculty to do more and more and more with less, and perhaps one might argue more and more and more testing in addition to the teaching that's going on, if we're not careful, some superintendents in some cases may be maybe forced or compelled or think that they are by pressures to voluntell teachers to teach courses that they may not be as prepared to teach because their master's is in teaching and in the pedagogy of teaching children through the K-12 system. And my concern is that in some cases, programs meant to try and take somebody who has great professional experience teaching K-12 into teaching content area that they may not have a lot of experience or a lot of education in teaching, and that the net result will be, in some cases, students believing they have completed collegiate level work, going other places, other states, or perhaps even here, expecting that collegiate level work to be accredited and counted as such, and then finding out that they need to take courses over and not having the ability because of the way financial aid works. My concern is we may be asking a lot of the K-12 teachers, and my other concern is at the end of the day, I think sometimes we think that because K-12, the K-12 profession is accredited and that their master's degree is in education and that the folks involved in that profession know a whole lot about teaching kids in that environment, that necessarily always transfers over to teaching at the collegiate level. And while I believe that good teachers can teach, I also believe that content area expertise is essential as well. I emphasize in the letter I've handed out that I understand that some of these programs are very similar to what some universities do with their graduate teaching assistants. Mm-hmm. That there is a direction, there is a program, there is a recipe, if you will, there is a supervisor over it, and that those folks also don't have above a bachelor's level material when they're teaching collegiate level classes. I suggest to you the difference is they're currently, at least GTAs, are currently engaged in study of that academic material while they're under supervision, and that we must be careful in whatever programs we recognize as our structures and systems to deliver collegiate level experience, and that in our effort to do all the right things, to provide the most opportunities for folks, that we don't create an environment where we end up pushing folks beyond what is fair to ask, and in some cases having systems that are not as robust, not as secure as some others. That's the point of the bill, to cause a conversation, to talk about what should be required. The approach was very simple. If someone wants to teach at the collegiate level, there are standards out there that generally go with hiring of permanent faculty. I understand that those credits And that experience costs additional money for folks in the process, and we're trying to find ways, affordable ways, to make that collegiate level experience more available. I just caution that we don't, for the purpose of affordability, trade quality.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay. I have, maybe it's more of a question than a comment, because I know it now, all educators have to have master's degrees. And when I taught, only secondary teachers had to. And so I have an NMAT. But of the 50 hours I took, one was an education course and 45 were content. Mm-hmm. So I would assume something like that would qualify as the 27 hours?
Chair Doherty, absolutely.
Okay.
The over recent years, some of, again, I only know from my own experience, the experience mm-hmm. of working in and out of universities and colleges the last 20 years, the folks that are teaching the K-12 environment, because of a lot of changes and a lot of other requirements, don't always leave the education program that they entered with a mastery of a particular content area in terms of a lot of credits. They've had to make changes. And I have a number of friends that wish they had more of a particular content area when they're teaching their normal K-12 classes.
Mm-hmm.
I think Oregon does a very good job of training our K-12 teachers. My concern is for those that have a master's degree in education as opposed to a particular content area, that if you're going to be telling other states that this student has completed at the collegiate level these credits, it really needs to be as rigorous. And I can tell you right now, I see students in my classes every day that have had some collegiate level coursework, and it is not the same as what we demand at the college. Now, I'm not trying to say that is always the case, but I think it is important as we look at trying to make sure that we have very good teachers trained in how people learn and trained in how people can put forward information, we include added content as well. So in your case, yes, absolutely. If you could teach at a college level with 45 credits, I mean, certainly.
Well, actually, add another 45 on top of that.
Okay.
But that was also back in the days we used to pay for tuition reimbursement. But anyway, any other questions or comments? Representative Reardon?
So don't pretend to be up to speed on this bill, and I apologize for that. So would this credential, or would this ability to teach the college level class in the K-12 area, would that be identified on the teaching license in some way, or that?
Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, I can't speak to the K-12 side. That's not my expertise.
Okay.
But what I know is, that in the last year there were a bunch of us that were called together to try to help put together. Actually, the last 2 years. We're asked to put together the curriculum of how we would prepare K-12 teachers to teach college-level classes. And my confusion on that one was, I don't know how we do that. I was excluded from that particular work group because of my confusion. What I know is that in different programs, and I believe there are a number around the state, and you're going to hear from folks that disagree with the bill in a few minutes, that are putting on some of those programs, that certain K-12 teachers that are involved in different kinds of programs of support are involved in teaching students collegiate level academics. My point is, some of those are very good. I'm not concerned about the very good ones. I'm concerned about where this will go when we have a less than clear requirement, and districts are pushed to ask more and more of their K-12 teachers to teach not just their K-12 curriculum, but also collegiate-level curriculum.
Okay, great.
That's my concern.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have two panels, one K-12 folks and one higher ed, so I'm going to put the two together. So I think, first of all, with the higher ed, Colleen Drago Starr, Dr. Mark Mulvihill, and David McDonald. Thank you. And make sure. sure you identify yourself for the record before you testify.
No problem.
Thank you very much.
Who goes first?
Go ahead.
Okay. I'd be happy to. Good afternoon, Chair Daugherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carlene Drago Starr. I am the Academic Partnership Coordinator for Oregon Tech, and I'm also the co-leader of the Accelerated Credit Work Group for the South Metro Salem STEM Partnership, which is one of Oregon's six funded STEM hubs. I am responsible daily for developing accelerated credit relationships and articulation agreements for the Office of Academic Agreements at Oregon Tech. We have a really robust programming. We have over 80 academic partnerships that are both involved in the high schools and the community colleges. So we're pretty familiar with this topic. Today, I'm currently speaking on behalf of all seven of Oregon's public universities. We are all in agreement with the legislators' current policy direction to increase the number of students who have the opportunity to really access accelerated learning. Numerous research studies have shown over and over that students who engage in whether it's dual credit or AP or IB or accelerated credit are actually more they actually use those credits by getting to the college, so they use those actual credits in college, and then they also are more successful when they get to college. So studies have shown that they persist through a degree program in getting those college credits early on in their academic careers. As part of the South Metro Salem STEM activity, we are very engaged in promoting STEM-related dual credit to our 15 school districts that we are in partnership with. And one of the goals is really reaching underrepresented students who believe that they may not have an opportunity to access college credit. And we're doing that by targeting their families through outreach events, through marketing campaigns and testimonial videos of students who have actually engaged in dual credit, and then also a poster campaign. The seven public universities concur that awarding accelerated credit is a proven student success strategy, and again, we applaud the expansion of these programs. Oregon's public universities understand the intent of HB 3126 is really intended to make good on our promise to provide high-quality education to these students while also looking at teacher credentialing and providing some oversight on quality teachers to deliver this college course content. The intent of this bill is to ensure that the teachers who teach to dual credit have similar, if not the same, teacher content in the subject area. However, HB 3126, as currently written, may actually decrease the ability of colleges to offer and award dual credit. HB 3126 would make it more difficult and more restrictive for us and my current program to approve high school teachers. Dual credit programming in the state of Oregon, many of those programs actually follow state standards that have been adopted by the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships, what we refer to as NACEP. And those requirements have been adopted by the Higher Education Coordinating Commission in June of 2014, and the commission has actually talked to the oversight committee who evaluates programs to really look at other programming that doesn't exist under the dual credit umbrella and start to begin to get some standards around those different accelerated credit programs for the state of Oregon. The Oregon Standards and Oversight Committee provide colleges and universities a really clear path towards articulating dual credit. They look at things like how we align curriculum universally, how we register and support students through this process, as well as comparing standards and providing course evaluations. These standards allow colleges and university flexibility to conduct rigorous assessments of teacher qualifications and to really enter into a partnership with the high schools that is about mentoring teachers, which we think is really important and a critical component of our program. These relationships over time can really build critical bridges so that students are better prepared for college-level work, so that students don't experience remedial coursework when they get to our institutions, and that ultimately we can really provide some more seamless transitions for our students going to college. At the core of dual credit programming, we're saving students money, and that is really exciting for a lot of families, especially low-income students, by providing them the lowest-cost college credit, yet equally challenging by having that oversight as institutions. The public universities urged the committee to focus on ensuring quality through the use of state standards that encourage growth and access in accelerated credit, and we recommend that you offer us more flexibility to mentor and qualify teachers through this process rather than making it more difficult. Today, we urge you to not support HB 3126, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Chair Doherty, I'm Mark Mulvihill. I'm the superintendent of Intermountain ESD in Eastern Oregon.
You don't have to be so close.
I'm blowing you away there.
We've got you.
It does say 12 inches. Okay. And I'm also serve on the Oregon Education Investment Board, and I'm here to oppose Bill 3126. I'm also representing the partners of the Eastern Promise, Blue Mountain Community College, Eastern Oregon University, Treasure Valley Community College, Intermountain ESD, and Malheur ESD. To kind of take you back in time a little bit, 6 years ago we were having this conversation, and we sat down, I convened a meeting with the college presidents of those institutions, and we talked about what are we going to do for our kids? What are we going to do to increase access when we're out in a rural, isolated area? What are we going to do for college affordability when the average Oregon student's in debt anywhere from $20,000 to $30,000? And what are we going to do about this issue of remediation, where many of our kids are not prepared and forced to take remedial classes, the Math 95, the Writing 115, the classes that don't count toward a degree? What are we going to do to make a change for that? And we really identified the fundamental problem to making change was the master's degree issue with dual credit, meaning that how the two master's degree and the OAR at the time really caused a conflict. If you're a K-12 teacher, you normally get a master's or a bachelor's in the content area, then you get your master's in teaching. Higher ed, it's the opposite. They're not congruent. And so what was happening is, unless a K-12 teacher by chance got the right master's degree, they couldn't offer college credit. So you would have in a high school at Pendleton, teacher A who had the right master's, teacher B didn't have the right master's. That one gave college credit, that one didn't. You can see what game started to be played in the high school, and you can imagine the types of kids that got into teachers A and the types of kids who didn't have advocacy for teacher B. So we had a vision to change this. What if we were to step outside the box and quit looking at teacher qualifications, which the research is very weak on, and look at student performance? Let the students dictate whether they have a performance level that indicates they've earned college credit, like AP, like baccalaureate. Those do not require teacher-specific credits. They are based on the performance of the child on multiple assessments. So we went with that vision, and we created professional learning communities where the college faculty is the one that determines the rigor, determines the curriculum, and determines the assessments in a group setting. It became a tremendous professional development opportunity that broke down the barriers between the institutions, where in the same room you had K-12 teachers that came from high schools as small as 100 to high schools as big as 1,500 in the same room with university and community college faculty to determine what is it we really expect out of our kids for writing 121. And we built it on the bedrock of the AAOT degree. And we drove the price down to $10 per credit. And the results last year was a saving to our families in 34 high schools in Eastern Oregon of $1.7 million, in which 30,000 credits were awarded to our kids that our college faculty partners have determined those kids meet proficiency levels. And what we actually found in the research conducted by Northwest Ed recently is that our kids who were in our proficiency classes where the teacher degree did not matter actually performed our kids at the same or outperformed our kids in the traditional dual credit. It's kind of a game changer. On OEIB, there's been an allocation to scale that up across multiple sites, and you're going to hear that around the state. This is messy work. This is hard work. This is breaking down silos between institutions for the betterment of our kids, but we're making a lot of progress. And we're seeing access for kids. We're seeing kids that have more preparation. They've been exposed to college. It aligns to the achievement compacts where we have an indicator of 9 credits, and we're making progress. This bill would take us back to the conversation 6 years ago, where we are now valuing what a teacher took in college more than a professional learning environment of educators getting together to determine their curriculum and aligning it and determining assessments and making it very clear to students what they have to do to earn college credit. So with that, I'm really urging a no vote on this. I believe it takes us back in time that we have overcome recently through the Eastern Promise and similar initiatives.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dave McDonald. I'm the Associate Provost at Western Oregon University. That title probably means next to nothing to everybody in this room. It means very little on my campus as well, because an Associate Provost is one of those catch-all basins where we do a little of everything. My primary responsibility is to make sure as a university we are providing all of our students, whether they be in our dual credit programs or enrolled in our undergraduate or graduate programs, the highest quality experience. I want to make sure that when they walk out with their diploma, that they can look back and say, wow, I learned a great deal at Western, and they prepared me well for my future. We are a late entry into the dual credit world. We are a very eager entrant to the world, and I want to kind of thank the representative for bringing this topic to you, because I think the world of dual credit has changed dramatically. Just in the last couple of years, never mind the last 6 years, the last couple of years, it has changed dramatically. Now, the hat I wear when I leave here is the hat of a father, and my son is graduating, Lenny Luck, in 3 months from Corvallis High School. My daughter is a middle school student there, and I am grateful that both of them have had, or will have, in my daughter's case, dual credit opportunities. I have had conversations with the high schools that are much richer than any conversation I had at any point in time prior to my career. Conversations about how do the high schools work with the universities and colleges to make sure their teachers are teaching at the highest possible level, that their students are getting the exposure and the entree points into a college experience in a way that moves 40-40-20 in tremendous, almost light-speed fashion. To see a student who never before saw themselves as college material all of a sudden realize that they have the intelligence, they have the ability to go on and succeed in college, is truly one of the most special rewards I get as an educator. When I get to see a 16 or 17 or 18-year-old who never believed before that they could go to college, now because they earn a dual credit course and earn an A or B, realize they have the potential. And I know that from an outcome standpoint, that A or B is truly a legitimate and a very strong A or B. It's a meaningful degree because our high school teachers are now working in conjunction with the university faculty and college faculty to make sure that Writing 121 truly is a meaningful composition course that prepares that student for college-level work as a writer, something that didn't exist 10 years ago. We're closing the gaps with these dual credit opportunities. Much more than simply helping a student earn a credit, we're empowering a campus, a college, and a high school to become partners in a way that helps students. Dual credit today is outcomes-based in one model. It is something that we're looking at. How good are we doing? When we're not doing well, we should close those opportunities down and reformat them and fix them. But that's not the case. We are doing so much better today than we have in the past. I'm going to leave you with one example. Recently, we've been an active partner in the Willamette Promise, which one of my colleagues will describe. We had one of our writing faculty members, a full professor who has 25 years teaching experience at the university, cross-score the work students submitted in writing that then earned grades from the university. And these were graded originally by high school teachers. She cross-scored every one of them that was submitted winter term. In one case out of about 100, she found a grade differential. She actually gave the student a higher grade than did the high school teacher. So in terms of that reliability, inner score reliability that we're very seriously, you're not going to get higher than 99%. And yet that's what we found. Across teachers from multiple school districts in multiple schools, it is powerful. So Representative Evans, thank you very much for opening this conversation up. We do oppose the bill, but we're grateful for the opportunity to talk about what dual credit is today, and we'd be glad to come back and share data with you and really explain to you why we think this may be one of the best things to happen between colleges, universities, and high schools in a generation. So thank you.
Yeah, fine. Thank you. Any questions of the panelists?
You were very thorough in your presentations, Madam Chair, and I appreciate all the we were listening. We honestly do. We appreciate your information. But I don't really have a question.
Okay. Well, no, I was looking at Representative Reardon. Well, it looks like he was formulating a question there.
Well, thank you for being so observant. You were an excellent former teacher.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, it was that look on their face of, huh?
That's my usual look. Thanks. But is there some mechanism, requirement that there's a requirement that you're... See, I told you I didn't have it well formulated, that classes are developed together with the college. So is that the current legal requirement, that their classes are being developed this way?
Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, there's a number of models, but all the models now are built around collaboration between the college and university faculty and the high schools. In the Willamette Promise, the courses aren't the focus. It's the learning. Right, and the right. outcomes and the assessments, and those are built in conjunction with each other so that a high school teacher is working towards learning that the college faculty have deemed with the high school teacher as being most critical for that course. So it is done in partnership, absolutely.
Excuse me.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry to be so nitpicky, but is it a requirement of some kind? You said it's a model. Is it a legally or rule-required model, or is it just a good idea that everybody picked up on?
Yes.
So we're speaking about, excuse me, Representative Darty and Representative Reardon. We're speaking about different programming here. And so what's new in the state of Oregon is really more of these replication grants or proficiency-based models that are coming out. What's been operating for a really long time are dual credit models. And you're probably referring to what I kind of referred to in my initial testimony with the dual credit oversight and the Oregon state standards. And so there is a process of really looking at the curriculum that's being delivered in the high school and matching that to the college level curriculum. And that happens in any program. So to really facilitate and to be part of the Oregon State standards, that process of alignment already happens. And that's happening between a mentorship between the faculty member, who at Oregon Tech would be considered the faculty liaison, and then the high school teacher who has actually been qualified. And we qualify based on a number of different qualifications, things like looking at the master's in teaching and education, as well as the bachelor's level content area and the experience they have in teaching the subject. Now, other schools, community colleges, often look at a master's in the specific content area and the teacher having a significant amount of credits in that content area. I have with me today faculty qualifications from each school if you guys want to have this for your...
We have it on all
you
list.
Do. Yeah. Perfect. So each school is a little bit different in how they facilitate that with dual credit, but there is a process.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the next three we have up are Andy Gardner, Keith Usury, and Alan Kirby.
Okay. It's all right, I'll go first. Representative Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Andy Gardner. I'm the superintendent of the North Sandingham School District in Staten. I also have served this year as an advisory board member for the Willamette Promise, which is the replication of what Dr. Mulvihill had done in Eastern Oregon. Through the OAIP, we implemented a replication grant this year in the region of Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. The 21 districts here have created the partnership, along with Chemeketa, Western Oregon University, Oregon Institute of Technology, and Corbin. At some point, we hope to have play a role as well. A couple of things. First, Representative Reardon, your question about just the rigor and how we check that. we at the end of this year will see whether our teachers were able to teach it well enough and whether our kids were able to demonstrate that proficiency. So we have checks in a proficiency-based system to determine whether there are true student-based results.
Okay.
Which is not always the case, and I'll do a credit. There's not a student result outcome at the end like a proficiency-based model will be. And I know Mr. Yusuri will talk about that more in depth. Second thing, I think you may have heard from some of our parents and others about funding over the last couple weeks, and I want to make the point that this is an efficiency in our system that is really guaranteed or drives at the idea of creating a more educated Oregon populace over time. When community colleges, four-year universities, and K-12 are all competing for the same money, one of the great things about this is we have efficiencies that we gain through this system. We have kids that are able to accelerate further. You may hear some opinion today, and I ask that you look for the research. And I would cite not my opinion, but John Hattie's book, Visible Learning, which summarizes the contributions of teacher education to the student and student achievement. By the way, he lists that as very low. Teacher education subject knowledge is not strong. Acceleration is very high. And I know you heard Carlene Drago-Starr talk about that. Accelerating students to their appropriate level. And there are kids in John Day and Jordan Valley and Staten, where I live, that are in smaller districts that are every bit as capable as students in bigger schools where more teachers have master's degrees and 27 hours of content. And they need to have access to this as well. We can't get the Oregon we want until we extend those opportunities to them. The final thing that I would say is this bill, which I oppose, is a short-term difference of opinion. Our goal is to increase the number of kids who go to community college and go to four-year degrees. We do that by creating confidence in them, by creating college-going environments. And so we recognize and we hope that we can move beyond the idea that we threaten and that we actually want to increase the total number of students moving through the system to higher education. Again, I oppose the bill. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Next.
Well, good afternoon, Chair Doherty and Vice Chair Springer and Frederick. My name is Keith Ussery, and I'm the Deputy Superintendent at Willamette ESD. Pardon my voice and a little bit of a allergy thing going on today. So I'd like to share.
We're in the Mid-Valley.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 3126, which, as we've discussed, would establish a minimum level of credits required for each teacher to participate in a dual credit course. In the education world and in the world of policymakers, there's a strong desire to equate quality and success and improvement with some numerical value. And in the case of House Bill 3126, that number is 27, and more specifically, 27 hours of graduate-level coursework. And there's clear evidence that this approach, while well-intentioned, would lead Oregon in the wrong direction. And I'm going to share with you three key reasons why I believe that the minimum standards approach that's outlined in 3126 should be rejected as an alternative to the progress that we've already made in this area. First, the quality of dual credit programs should be measured by student outcomes rather than teacher qualifications. On February 11, 2014, the College Board released the AP, or Advanced Placement, report to the nation. In 2013, 133,000 teachers in the United States taught advanced placement courses. In next month, more than 1 million students in the United States will take advanced placement exams. And if the current trends hold, more than 5,000 students in Oregon and 600,000 students nationwide will submit their scores to college and universities to earn credit or have their initial requirements waived. The College Board does not require AP teachers to meet a 27 credit minimum. In fact, they have no minimum credit requirements for teachers. Instead, they have established clear priority standards for each course and measure quality by examining evidence that students have or have not achieved college-level outcomes. Again, by using common assessments, the College Board focuses on what students know and are able to do. This practice ensures comparability from state to state, from school to school, and from student to student. Second, establishing minimum academic standards for dual credit teachers does little to ensure students are achieving college level outcomes. Some dual credit programs in Oregon require teachers to meet higher academic standards that are proposed in 3126. Unfortunately, few existing dual credit programs use common assessments, and even fewer dual credit programs cross-score assessments to ensure students are meeting the standards for college level courses. Some would argue that academic qualifications in a good measure of trust are suitable replacements for clearly articulated proficiency standards, common assessments, and regular dialogue between high school teachers and university faculty. My experience as a former high school principal, teacher, and dual credit instructor have led me to conclude the opposite. We need clear proficiency standards. We need opportunities for dialogue among university faculty and high school teachers. And we need common assessments to ensure that the quality of any dual credit program. What we don't need is a prescriptive or arbitrary set of standards to qualify teachers to do dual credit. Third and finally, we need to establishing minimum teacher qualifications may undermine innovative programs. For the past 11 months, partners from 20 school districts and four higher education institutions, including Western Oregon University, Chemeketa Community College, Oregon Institute of Technology, and Corbin University, have worked together to build an improved system for awarding college credits to students in Oregon's high schools. Our task has been to break with tradition and implement a proficiency-based program that focuses on student outcomes rather than inputs. The Willamette Promise currently serves 1,650 students in 25 high schools in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill counties. Similar to the College Board, we have focused on identifying what students need to know and be able to do before being granted college credit. And with the guidance of our university and college faculty partners, we've constructed clear proficiency statements for each of the 20 courses we offer. We also use common assessments to ensure comparability of results. And we have cross-scoring protocols in place to ensure that proficiency is achieved before credit is granted. House Bill 3126 would have a negative impact on Willamette Promise and other innovative programs, but it would be an impact felt disproportionately by small and rural schools and underserved student populations. I encourage the committee to reject traditional, arbitrary methods for ensuring quality among dual credit programs in Oregon. In closing, I believe the presence of alternatives ensures or encourages quality, efficiency, and innovation, not the opposite. When we challenge the status quo, people and systems respond, refine, and improve. And that's exactly what's happened over the last 5 years with Eastern Promise and is now happening in other replication sites around the state.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Mr. Kirby.
Thank you, Chairperson Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Alan Kirby, and I'm the principal of Staten High School over in Staten, Oregon. Go Eagles. You've heard a lot of good arguments from my colleagues today, but I would like to just talk about a few different groups, specifically teachers and students and parents. Teachers who are in the Willamette Promise and working for this college credit you've heard of, it is a lot of work for them, but it is work that they want to engage in. It is work they're excited about because they know that they can tell their students, you can get college credit for working at this level. You can do it. And it gives the students that motivation to take that next step, to work even harder to get to that point. It tells the students that we always say to them, we're preparing you for college at high school level. We're preparing you for college. Now we're showing them you're doing that level of work. You can do that. And not only that, you can get the credits, and college is a possibility for you. They're able to see that it isn't just talk, but they are learning at that high level and that they are capable of doing that. And in rural Oregon and Staten, although it's not that far from here, is rural Oregon. Students sometimes don't really believe that that's possible. It is also for the students a big cost benefit as well, as you've heard today, that they have opportunity to afford these credits and to come out from that. So as we've been building Willamette Promise, I've looked at the OTM, which is the first year of college credits that students get, not just a number, but the actual classes that they're to take that would transfer from any college to another college in Oregon. And we at Staten High School, next year, I'm about to roll this paper out that will tell parents, next year, eighth grade parents especially that I'm going to go talk to here soon, you can have your students have their full first year of college done at Staten High School. That is a powerful thing to tell parents and a powerful motivator for them and their students to work at a high level and to know, I can do this, and I have opportunities, as many opportunities as I want, to get to the next level. It has really been a big change for our school. I'm a first-year principal, so there's been a lot of big changes for me. But to see this and to work on this and prepare this for my school and to work with Willamette Promise has been one of the most exciting changes that I have seen in education in some time. As a former dual-credit teacher as well, it's something that I longed for a long time. AP is one model, and it is a good model, but the opportunity to work and collaborate with college professors and faculty to create that curriculum for my staff has been very exciting. They know that they get to have a chance to help their students work for something even bigger than they are in now. Parents, finally, they're also excited because, as I said, they know their kids are working at that high level, and that's going to open up the door for them to realize that they can do it, that they have the ability to do that college-level work, and that opens their eyes to what their possibilities might be for their future. So I, as well, am opposed to House Bill 3126 because I believe it will close some of those doors for my students. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of this panel? Yeah? You guys did a great job. Okay, thank you very much. That's what we have signed up. Anybody else would like to speak on 3126? Okay, seeing none, I close the public hearing on 3126 and open up a public hearing on 3363.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3363 prohibits school districts from allowing certain promotional activities for food or beverage items that do not meet minimum nutritional standards. Declares an emergency effective July 1, 2015. The committee has been asked to consider the Dash 3 amendments, which insert background relating to childhood obesity and food industry advertising.
Okay, thank you. Who do we have? Representative Reardon, Cassandra Griffin, and Jim Thomas. That's what I have on the paper. Anybody in there all signed up here? Oh, wait. Thank you. Are you beginning, Representative Reardon?
Thank you, Chair Doherty, and good afternoon, especially fine-looking committee. thank you for having us this afternoon. I am Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48, and I'm very pleased to have you here. This bill, excuse me. I'm going to give a brief introduction to House Bill 3363 regarding junk food marketing in schools. And, as a former educator, I am too close, aren't I? I also know that health is important to our kids and their success in school. I also believe we have a national crisis in health, and especially diabetes, obesity, and other diet-related diseases. Oregon set strong nutrition standards back in 2007 for what foods can be sold in Oregon schools. This bill just proposes to have some restrictions on the type of advertising for those same foods. I did raise four children, four beautiful daughters, and I know how influential marketing can be. When your kids want to see a certain movie or eat a certain thing, you really kind of wonder, well, where do they come up with those ideas? And also kind of close to that is, as a former marketing teacher, kids were getting exposed to 3,000 ads a day, and is what I was told and what I believe. And so that has a lot to do with forming their habits around whether it be eating or what they wear or anything else. So the point is, advertising is very powerful. Medical establishment knows how influential marketing is too, and various medical groups have been calling for years for an end to marketing to kids of junk food, and it's not new, but our country hasn't taken action on it. The American Society of Pediatrics, the Institute of Medicine, and the World Health Organization all have policy statements calling for an end to marketing to kids. And the American Psychological Society is another group that recommends limiting marketing to kids. Way back in 2004, they issued a report that made a few key points, including reiterating that advertising works. quote, product preference has been shown to occur with as little as a single commercial exposure and is strengthened with repeated exposures. Most importantly, studies have shown that product preferences affect children's product purchase requests and that these requests do influence parents' purchasing decisions. Think about the last time you were in the market. You see little, you know, mom pushing that cart down there, little Johnny pointing at the stuff. They get that from the advertising. This bill initially proposed to set limits on advertising straight into the law, but the revised version asked the Oregon Department of Education to create some rules, and we can provide direction to the department on who we want to be on that group. Figure that out. When Cassandra came to me and asked me about sponsoring this bill, first thing I did was call my friend John Beyer, principal of David Douglas High School, because I'm really concerned about the impact on some of the funds that he had to work with from time to time. And he assured me that they would not be harmed by this. My second concern was what happens to the signs that are maybe on the baseball field and so forth. They do not have to tear the signs down when they finally wear out, and they can replace them and not have advertising. But they don't have to run around tearing down signs. They're not going to be losing money. So I think we're okay there. I grant that's not extensive research, but something. I want our schools to be doing everything they can to get our kids off to a good start. Good education is about a lot more than test scores and algebra, as we all know. We're trying to teach kids what they know in order to be successful in their lives, and one of those things is health. We've been struggling to afford PE and nutrition classes, so one thing we can do is at least stop marketing unhealthy foods in our schools. And I urge you to support me, or urge me to join me in supporting this bill.
Okay, thank you. Next.
I'll go next. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Cassandra Griffin. I work for Upstream Public Health, a statewide public health advocacy organization. We believe that smart policies are the best way to create communities that help people lead healthier, full lives. I'm here today to talk in favor of House Bill 3363 and the -3 amendments. Thank you to Representative Reardon for sponsoring the bill and to all of you for hearing it. In 2007, Oregon legislators, yourselves and your predecessors, did two important things for healthy food in Oregon schools. The first was to launch the Farm to School and School Garden program, which is putting healthy food into schools and promoting local products, teaching kids about gardening, getting them excited about eating those fresh grapes and turnip greens and all kinds of things. The other thing that Oregon did was pass a law restricting junk food sales in schools, specifically setting nutrition standards for snacks. That is because you can't succeed with getting kids healthy food habits through promotion alone of good things. You have to actually take away the bad things. So the 2007 law set nutrition standards based on calories, fat, and sugar content. The rules apply to all foods sold on campus except for the federal reimbursable school meals programs, which have their own standards. As of 2014, the federal snack standards finally caught up with Oregon. The nutrition requirements for lunch have also increased recently federally. So the staff and school cafeterias are working really hard to provide healthy foods and to encourage kids to eat them. House Bill 3363 does not change what can be sold on campus, when or where. It only addresses the marketing of foods on campus. It proposes that if a food or beverage item can't be sold because of those nutrition standards, that it shouldn't be marketed there either. It essentially closes a loophole because your predecessors probably thought that they were getting junk food out of schools when they passed the 2007 bill. This finishes the job by taking away the pictures and the ads and the coupons. In Oregon right now, you guys probably know this, over 53% of kids qualify for the free and reduced price meals program. That means that they are getting a lot of their calories at school, and they're getting a lot of their food education at school also. Those are kids whose families don't have the money to be buying the healthy fruits and vegetables and teaching them the food habits that we want them to learn. So if those kids are going to learn those habits, they're really learning them at school. It makes school a very important place to teach kids good food habits. What we're proposing in this bill is that Oregon should provide those kids and all kids with consistent messaging about good food and good health. The version of the bill that we're asking you to support today is the Dash 3 amendments, which completely replaced the original version of the bill. We discovered some problems with the original version, which tried to set marketing standards directly into the statute. So this version asks ODE to set standards instead. One of the motivations for this bill is that there is a diabetes epidemic threatening the health and the future of our kids. Another motivation is that there are federal standards addressing this coming down the way from the United States Department of Agriculture. Those rules are going to direct all school districts to take action to restrict marketing of non-nutritious foods at schools. What we are asking you to do now is to take statewide action and ask ODE to start working on consistent statewide standards for Oregon schools. When we talk about marketing on campus, we're talking about a few different common things and a variety of uncommon things. We're definitely talking about vending machines and what ads are on them. We're definitely talking about giving away coupons in classes. We're talking about signs in the hallway advertising cookie sales. As Representative Reardon mentioned, the issue of the actual signs in stadiums would be phased in so that when they need to be replaced, they can be replaced, but it's not immediate. The marketing that happens in Oregon schools is not horrible, but it does happen, and it contributes to a pervasive environment of marketing to our kids. So please take a stand in favor of our kids' health and phase out the remaining junk food marketing from Oregon schools. I'm asking you, and the other testifiers today are asking it, and I also have 400 signatures on online petition that a national organization, Moms Rising, just put out in the past couple days. Thank you for your attention and service, and I would be happy to answer questions now or at the end after other people have testified.
We'll wait till Mr. Thomas has spoken. Okay, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Jim Thomas. I'm the superintendent of the McKenzie School District, and have about a half a century experience. That sounds impressive, you know. But anyway, half a century experience working with young people. So I've been the both private sector and public sector. I spent 10 years in SIO as a superintendent and the founding principal of Oregon Connections Academy. Been in Monument, Reedsport. Spent 3 years in Craig, Alaska and Prince of Wales Island. And I've had the opportunity to observe a lot of students in a lot of different health conditions with a lot of different types of food service programs. And much of the change that's taken place has been a positive, but we've still seen a real increase in the waistlines, decrease in the ambition and motivation of our students at times. And I'm not going to say that all of it has to do with marketing and so forth of food. I mean, well, you know, I'll try not to digress, but being ADHD myself, that's hard not to do. But I know, like, we used to have 4 years of PE when we were young, you know, and we've done away with some of the physical requirements. Technology has taken away students being outside and playing. But a big part of what the kids get is based upon marketing and consumption of junk food. And that's basically what we're trying to change here. You know, much of the change has to do with diet that our students are eating both at school and at home. And there is a direct correlation between the quality of food students eat and academic outcomes. And those of you who have been in education know that when kids eat junk food, they tend not to be as good a student, and their graduation is affected because it affects the rates. They tend not to be involved in as many activities. And we've seen it all around us. Students who do not eat well also generally do not test well. And that's sad because they're putting themselves at a deficit. We do not have control over what students consume at home. But we do have a very strong voice in what kids learn about food while at school. And I believe it is that it should be healthy food all the time. We have made gains in the quality of food being served to our students over the last few years. However, for whatever reason, we have been either unable or unwilling to insist that advertising and consumption of junk foods in our schools be totally eliminated. The serving of high sugar content junk foods and drinks not only impacts the students' health, but also can impact classroom behavior. And those sometimes when you have breakfast, we're sometimes seeing schools with donuts, chocolate covered donuts for breakfast, and chocolate milk, and then they go to class. And you know, Chairman Doherty, I know you know what I'm talking about there. You know, and Representative Weirden, I think you've probably seen the same thing. So, you know, it's important that we keep this in mind. This isn't just a kind of a frivolous thing we're talking about. It does have a major impact. At the McKenzie School District, we do not have any vending machines at all. We also raise a bulk of our own vegetables, and we have probably a salad bar second to none. And our kids, because it's been given to them from K through the high school, they just accept the fact, and they partake in the salad bar and do very good. We're currently applying for a farm-to-school implementation grant from the USDA to expand our garden program to improve the quality of our students' meals at home. Because what that which we don't use in the school, we also provide for the community, which is kind of a different way of trying to take care of the health, not just at school, but at home. Because like many other things, you know, you can only do so much at school. And we need to somehow change the culture at home to really facilitate change in our schools. And that's not just in nutrition. That goes through a lot of different initiatives that have been proposed by the legislature. In addition to what I know as an educator, I have an important lesson, I've learned an important lesson on how important it is to have healthy foods personally. Had I had the education support of my school to be conscious about what I was eating, I would not have had to have three stents put in my heart when I was only 65. It took that event to really change my lifestyle in terms of diet and exercise. I've lost over 50 pounds since 2008. And I'm healthier now than I was my 40s, 50s, and 60s. I work out every single day. And I really believe had we had the same conscious effort that you guys are trying to make today and have made in the past, a lot of students who are now in my age category would not be having the issues that some of us have to have gone through. So, you know, our students deserve better, and you're in a position to make that change. And up to including realistically saving lives in the long run. You know, it's one of those things that accumulates over time. It's not something that happens from the day, you know, tomorrow, today you're healthy, tomorrow you're not. And I also agree that ODE should be directed to develop some consistent guidelines to be used statewide to ensure a more consistent food marketing program and ensure a healthier student population. And I do urge you to vote in favor of 3363-3. And keep junk food marketing out of our schools. And I do want to thank you for your attention and your initiative and hard work, not just on this, but I know you've had the school finance issues. Yeah, we've all been on that. So, you know, as I sat and looked at the agenda, I probably could have sat and talked on any one of them because of the interest we have as being a school superintendent. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm in the advertising and promotion business. But not this kind of stuff. But that just leads me to ask some questions here about a couple of things. One of those is what we continue and will undoubtedly continue to sell in our snack bars at our athletic contests on the high school level. Yearbook advertising, scoreboard advertising, sports program advertising. I don't disagree with one thing you've said about nutrition and the impact on our lives and kids and so forth. But the question I do have as a business person, and that is that, you know, I mean, I pay a lot of money into the local economy as a business with a large payroll and all of that. And so I'm pumping a lot of money out in the community that way. But on the other hand, I'm always having schools come to me asking me for my financial support in lots of different areas, many different areas. And because my station carries the high school games, I feel a certain obligation to finance many of the things that the school does. The question, though, that I have, and that's about the soft drink manufacturers who, of course, have been synonymous with high school sports events for years, advertising in the programs, the play-by-play programs and all that for years. The snack bar is selling all the stuff that they do with the company logos on cups and things like that. I'm just kind of wondering ultimately where you see this going in that the school districts have been so dependent on income from private business to support their extracurriculars. I would think that, you know, the people I know in the beverage business and the people who represent the products that we're selling in our own snack bars at the ball games would probably feel kind of funny about this. I would just ask you, where do you see this going with people like that ultimately?
Yeah, I'll speak to that if I may. Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, members of the committee. The American Beverage Association nationally has come out in support of the national standards that the USDA is going to ask school districts to follow. They said that they see removing marketing from schools as the next logical step. I don't have that quote in front of me, but I can get it to you. So at a national level, the Beverage Association has actually been on board. The request that we're making of them broadly is to advertise for the compliant products in their product line, not the non-compliant products in their product line. We're not asking them to stop advertising at all or stop supporting schools at all. Mm-hmm. The growth industry in beverages is mostly in the healthier product lines anyway. And so there's lots of room for them to be developing the flavored waters and the low-calorie sports drinks and to be marketing those products. I think that it all being full-fledged Coke and Pepsi is a remnant of the past, and that most of that is already being phased out because of the bill that was passed in 2007 restricting the sale of those foods at school. Now, you're talking about sporting events. And
if we could, we've got eight more people to testify on this bill. So if you could just kind of summarize, if you can, for Representative Wilson.
The rules on what can be sold and the rules about marketing apply for during the school day and when it's primarily students on campus. And the rules are different for the actual sporting events.
Okay. Thank you. Just one follow-up statement.
Very quickly, please.
And that would be the fact that we have a very large coffee chain, statewide coffee chain that is based in Grants Pass, has a trailer set up next to the football field, and it's the longest line of everything, including the school snack bar, you know, at the ball game. So I'm just kind of wondering ultimately where. And these people are huge benefactors.
And so what outside activities, games and that kind of stuff is not in this?
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Representative McLean.
Well, mine was similar. I think we've got, freedom of speech issues. I think that's why we went to rulemaking, I believe, is what I was told. And, I think it's real important to deal with free speech mm-hmm. issues up front. Also, I think it's real important to remember that I think the language says child-specific or primary child audience. I think that language in the bill is helpful. But I do, when you start talking about cookie sales, give me a break. And we're not talking about corporations here. We're talking about the speech and debate team trying to be able to go to tournaments. We're talking about the English Honor Society Club that decided to bring homemade cookies, to something. And we've got to be very specific about what we mean on site at school. And, I can't find that language in here, so I'll look at it a little bit more. But if you've got it, if you could get it to me, that would be great.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Representative Frederick.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I am concerned about something altogether different. We've talked about this before, and I ended up talking with several teacher friends of mine. And quite frankly, they said that there was a concern. The coupons that you have that are listed there, they, as one put it to me, yes, I use Pizza Hut coupons as a motivational device. If I put carrots out there, they would not do that. So there's a real concern about how we can, in fact, the ability for folks to use those coupons and discounted food and beverage as a reward is something that teachers use every day, and so that's a concern. And I'm not sure I understand what you're trying to get at here, but it goes against something that a lot of teachers have been using for centuries, I think, but certainly for decades, as a way of getting teachers there. So I don't know, we don't have a whole lot of time, but that's something that I want to bring out as a concern.
Okay, thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have asked for some data because we are assuming, first of all, I think all of us can agree healthier foods are better. I don't think that is the debate. I think the debate for me is, to what extent does the school control that and is effective? And I've asked for data, and thanks for getting back to me, but I said I want to see data that says what we're doing is working and impacting, and I haven't seen that yet. I would not argue that this is a bad plan and we ought to put junk food on the school lunch tray. That's not what I'm advocating. But I want to see that this is working. And to me, this bill comes down to, or the amendments now, you know, you mentioned cookie dough. School's got to be fun, too. School's just got to be fun. And, you know, cookie dough, if cookie dough makes it fun, I remember years back I was getting calls like crazy, when's the cookie dough coming out? And no, it does not prevent the sale of cookie doughs, but you better not put a homemade sign that you let your art class work on that cookie dough is for sale up on the wall. Mm-hmm. That's what this is talking about. This isn't eliminating the cookie dough. It's eliminating the art class from making cookie dough posters. I literally had friends contact me just a few couple months ago now. Our school served popcorn on Wednesdays for 25 cents for years. It was a ritual. It was special. It had to stop. It had to stop because of the quarter. There were signs up. I mean, school's got to be fun. School's got to be fun. And yeah, this legislature in 07 did pass a bill to ban a lot of that stuff, and we came back in 08, and I was one of them that said, let's let the teachers have Snicker bars in their teacher's lounge if they want it, because if a Snickers bar helps a kid's teacher get through the day once in a while, I'm okay with that. I'm okay. So, sorry, Madam Chair, I'm okay. Just not very excited about
I
this
I think
bill.
Those are more comments than questions. And then this has got to be really brief because we're going to have to, the rest of you out there, we're going to limit your testimony to 2 minutes.
May I just make one comment? I'd just like to say that Chairman Doherty, through this chair, to Representative Springer and Representative McLean, there has to be some common sense in anything we do. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing that one size does not fit all, and we do have to be look at things from a point of view of being rational and not overreact, but there are issues there that we still do need to deal with in terms of the advertising. The cookie dough thing, you know, I don't know why the popcorn thing, you know, all schools do that. But on the other hand, just because it's always been done doesn't always mean it's right, but then we do need to take a look at what's best interest of the kids in terms of their health as well as the common sense approach to coming up with realistic restrictions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any other questions? And I might be the only other person other than you that's been to Monument School.
So. You know where it is.
Oh, I know where I've been.
I spent a lot of time in Monument School.
Okay, next thing we have Leslie Stevens, Darlene Huntress, and Kyra Dakowitz. And we are going to limit your testimony to 2 minutes because a lot of it's here.
Go ahead, please. Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Darlene Huntress. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Action, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Health Equity Alliance. Thanks. I have a loud voice. Oregon Health Equity Alliance represents a collective effort of 38 member organizations who work together to make Oregon a more equitable place for all. Our coalition believes that every Oregonian should have an equal chance to achieve their full health potential. This is one of our priority bills for the 2015 legislative session, and we're here to express our strong and united support for HB 3363. 1 in 4 Oregon adolescents are overweight or obese, and we know that leads to heart disease, diabetes, and eventually early death. Experts estimate that in this country today, 40% of the children here will develop type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. This risk becomes even higher in people of color. Latinos and African American women have over a 50% chance of developing diabetes in their lifetime. Research shows that junk food advertising influences children's food choices, purchase requests, diet, and health. If it didn't work, companies wouldn't do it, but it does work, so the food industry spends nearly $2 billion a year marketing to kids. We believe it's one thing to advertise to adults who have developed brains and a supposed understanding of cause and effect. It's another thing entirely to advertise to kids. As a mom, I understand that they don't exactly have great impulse control or long-range thinking. In addition, and most importantly, low-income kids and kids of color see even more advertising about sugary treats, fatty treats, and salty treats than their whiter and wealthier counterparts. The increased amount of advertising exposure that kids of color experience is a contributing factor to their overall worse health conditions. This committee can't limit marketing to kids everywhere, but you can limit marketing to kids in the one important place where they spend many, many hours. Instead of school being one more place where junk food companies can get to our kids.
Okay, if you could summarize, we have your written testimony.
we're asking you to make it one place where they learn consistent and accurate things about food, health, and nutrition.
Okay, thank you. Next.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and Representative Reardon and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Stevens. I am an osteopathic family physician here in Salem, my hometown, for the past 10 years. I've also been a parent volunteer in the Salem Kaiser Schools for the past 10 years as well. I am here as a representative of Kaiser Permanente and Northwest Permanente in support of this bill. I'd like to point out that Kaiser Permanente, we care for 67,000 youths in Oregon, and only 64% of those are considered a healthy weight. It's actually more than one in four. Only 37% of children that we see in our clinics are a healthy weight. So despite excellent medical care, a significant portion of children have health risks associated with their weight. And it's really important that we intervene in every way that we can. We understand that, as it's been pointed out a couple of times, that the health food industry is very powerful. And they do have, we have evidence that their marketing does influence our youth. And we are asking for a safe place where children can go for a consistent message about healthy lifestyle and be marketing free. Okay, so I would ask your support on this House bill.
Okay, thank you very much.
Great. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet. I'm here representing Kira. She had to leave early to volunteer in her child's class. I am a parent as well, and I have a student who has just started in kindergarten, so I can speak to this as well. I work for the American Heart Association as our regional manager on these issues. So I'm going to read Kira's piece and then also work to submit her written testimony. Kira's youngest daughter has a July birthday, which means she's younger than most of her peers and learned to read a lot later than her peers. And it took a lot of work to learn through kindergarten and first grade. She came home one day so proud that she had finished two books at school and got a special prize. That prize was a coupon for a pizza-sized chocolate chip cookie from Figaro's, a reading incentive. I was excited that she was reading and excited she was so proud of herself, but not excited about a pizza-sized cookie from Figaro's. What about a new book or a cool journal or a pen? There are so many incentives that would have charmed my daughter into reading. Promoting highly processed sweet treats isn't what I want to encourage for my kids. And this is a dilemma we face daily as parents, educators, and community members when we allow companies to advertise to our kids in schools. Kira is a parent and an educator. She lived in Salem most of her life, and her 10-year-old is at McKinley, and her 12-year-old is at Leslie. She's taught in middle school and high school English and English as a second language, and she's currently working as an instructional coach for Central School District in Independence. So education is one of her passions. She's very fortunate to volunteer in her kids' classes and has helped start work with the school garden programs and the farm-to-school efforts. Capturing her testimony here, and like I said, I'll submit it and just speak in on behalf of myself. As a parent, we work really hard to help make sure that we're instilling our kids good, healthy choices. It's hard with all the media marketing that they get everywhere. I think school is one of those places where we want them to be safe and be supported in making those nutrition healthy choices. So I am proud to be here to represent her as well as myself, and urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of the panel? Okay, thank you. Next we have Linda Roman, Sarah Higginbotham, and that's it. And then we have after that Tricia Smith, Lori Wimmer, and Morgan Allen. Okay, so go ahead and start.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony. My name is Linda Roman from the Oregon Latino Health Coalition. We're a statewide health advocacy organization that works to inform and shape health policy. We're also here as a member of the Oregon Health Equity Alliance. I'm here to urge for your support on the passage of House Bill 3363 out of this committee. I'd like to bring your attention to a number of figures. At the time of the 2010 census, Latinos were almost 12% of the Oregon's population. Most importantly, Latinos represent 43% of the population growth in the prior 10 years in Oregon, and the single fastest growing ethnic group. The Latino population is younger than other segments of the Oregon population, and 25% of Oregon's public schools students are Latino. Because our community tends to be younger, we need to ensure that we are thinking about the health of Oregon's future. We as a state need to do more to ensure that these kids are getting a healthy start. According to the 2013 report from Salud America, the national organization focused on reducing the obesity epidemic among Latino youth. Currently, 39.1% of Latino youth ages 2 to 19 are overweight or obese, compared to 27.9% of non-Latino white youth. Diet is a central component of overweight and obesity to a variety of environmental, social, and economic cultural factors that may contribute to Latino youth's diet practices. I want to bring to your attention to one last figure. The leading food and beverage companies spend nearly $2 billion annually to market branded foods and beverages to young people. These companies know how to target us. They know how to find us. They know how to speak our language. And so because of that, we are concerned about this kind of advertising for our Latino youth in Oregon.
Thank you. If you could summarize, please.
Yes. So I urge your support for this House Bill 3363-3.
Hey, thank you very much. Sharon?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Higginbotham. I'm here today on behalf of the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association. I will be exceptionally brief because everyone has covered most of what I wanted to say. We do support the bill. We support the DASH-3 amendments. I wanted to highlight additionally that the National Parent-Teacher Association and the National Association of State Boards of Education taken formal positions against advertising to kids in schools. Also, just wanted to highlight one other note. That I would be happy to follow up with committee members later with a report by the Center for Science in the Public Interest that highlights the number of physical activity fundraisers, healthy food fundraisers, non-food incentives that are happening around the country. The American Heart Association alone is aware of a number of healthy fundraisers and activities that happen right here in our state. So we do believe there are a number of alternatives that are just as fun as a lot of other things and just as helpful to school fundraising efforts. And with that, I'll wrap up. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. We have Tricia Smith, Lori Wimmer, Morgan Allen.
Madam Chair, while they're approaching, I just want to do a shout out for Iris from Stanford Children, who I saw eating a carrot here in this setting. And I just think that is the true example of what we're doing here today.
Yeah, I give my left finger for a Snickers bar right now.
That's not what she was eating earlier.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's no eating in the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Even healthy eating?
Even healthy eating. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care of that.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association here in support of the DASH-3 version of House Bill 3363 because good health is fundamental to readiness to learn, as you've heard from so many others before us. I'll be very brief. We believe that kids are more vulnerable to marketing than are adults, and that schools are not good places for that kind of marketing activity to occur, particularly with respect to something that is more a poison than a medicine, as my daughter is a nutrition student would tell you. Finally, the last reason that we would be supportive of the DASH-3 version of this bill is that given that federal standards are on their way to us this summer, we're also told that each school district would be individually responsible for figuring out how to comply with those standards. If this bill were to pass in this form, we suspect that one standard guidance would be more helpful to those school districts rather than having to invent it in 197 different ways.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. Just up front, I might be a slightly different voice on this issue. We do the school board system. We fully support banning junk food ads and marketing, and we shouldn't be marketing squishies and cheesy poofs to our kids while they're in school. Totally agree with that. But we do have some questions, or at least we'd like to probably see some clarifications beyond the DASH-3 amendments. And just I want to put a couple of those on the record. The first is,
The USDA is coming out with federal rules, supposedly sometime this summer, and this bill specifically directs our State Board of Education to make rules about the same issue. So potentially we could be faced with two sets of rules, so maybe we could say in the bill that at minimum the State Board has to wait until the federal guidelines are issued. That might be a possibility. And I think there's some questions about whose rules would trump in certain situations. Sometimes federal rules and policies override state policies. Sometimes there's latitude for states to do different things. So I think we might need to do that. And I would just mention the State Board already has authority to do this. You're just actually telling them to do something. They have the authority to make rules on this issue. But a couple things we'd like to get some clarity on. Representative Reardon mentioned the idea of like the sports scoreboard that may have a Pepsi logo on. I think we'd want the bill to explicitly say that you wouldn't have to replace it because it prohibits it. But what do you do? And we wouldn't want the State Board to say, well, you have to replace it. So beyond normal wear and tear. So when you're ready to replace your scoreboard with the old Pepsi sign on it, that would be one thing I think we'd like to get some clarification. I think we do have some concerns about the fundraisers, putting up posters if you're selling Choco bars to raise money for band. You couldn't put posters up around the school and market it around the school. And I think the other concern is currently written, I think it would prohibit actual donations of food to basically school celebrations. If you're wanting to have a school ride celebration for something good related to academics, at least that's what how I read it, you couldn't get the local grocery store or pizza joint to donate food to that event. It would prohibit it, and it would require the board to write rules to do that. So we'd like to see some clarifications. We told the advocates this, certainly willing to work with them, but overall support the general policy idea, just do have some general concerns.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay. If not, we had no one else signed up. Anyone else want to speak on this? Okay, if not, I close the public hearing on House. There was somebody out there. Okay. I close the public hearing on House Bill 3363, and Morgan, you can probably stay up here. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2597. And if you want to remind us what this is, because there have been some amendments with this.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2597 did a number of things, but the committee's been asked to consider the dash twos, which replace the measure and require that any notice of truancy delivered to a truant student must state that a parent has the right to request an individualized education program or IEP evaluation meeting. Or if the student is already on an IEP, that the parent can request an IEP review. The dash twos further require that any truancy proceedings, including but not limited to those that lead to legal citation against parents that are issued by school administrators, must be paused until the conclusion of that request is made.
Okay. If you could explain the process you guys went through.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, again, Morgan Allen from the Oregon School Boards Association. As you remember, the original bill essentially required a IEP evaluation. Truancy would trigger an IEP evaluation, and I think there are some concerns from school districts about that. So we had a work group that was put together by your staff and Mr. Donovan that had folks from school districts, special education folks, school psychologists, representatives from COSA, OSBA, OEA, and others, as well as the advocates from the Autism Society and staff from Representative Buckley's office, kind of the folks that were involved in this. And I think we came up with a good compromise, which is essentially that rather than automatically triggering an IEP evaluation, that if there are truancy notices, that would include information so the parents know they have the right to ask for an IEP initial evaluation or a reevaluation if they might come to the conclusion that the truancy is related to some sort of special education activity. The other thing that we heard that was concerning was that in some instances where there were legitimate special education concerns, there were truancy proceedings that were moving ahead and families could potentially be fined while their student is being evaluated for an IEP. And so there's language in the amendment that would essentially stop the truancy proceedings during the IEP review. And we think that's very reasonable and rational. And appreciate you working with Mr. Jackson from the Autism Society and other folks. And I think we've got a good compromise and would appreciate you passing it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions about the amendments? Okay, quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So do we have anybody else testifying on the amendments, like Mr. Jackson?
No.
Well, yes.
I'm available.
For questions? Yeah. Okay. The question is your group in support of the Dash 3 amendments?
Yeah. You have to get on the record, Mr. Jackson.
Brief follow-up then on that.
For the record, Shane Jackson, lobbyist for the Autism Society of Oregon, and we are very pleased with the process that has occurred, and we are in support of Dash 2.
Okay.
follow up then. Mr. So Morgan, started calling you Mr. Morgan. Will this be, how much additional work will this be for school districts? I mean, giving out the information you have the right to an IEP meeting should not be the most cumbersome process in the world. Is there anything in addition to that?
Representative Springer, we don't believe that this will be cumbersome for school districts to implement. Essentially, when there's already a requirement, I believe, in the statute that you have to get a truancy notice, this would just require some additional information within that notice. And I think it's very reasonable. We heard a couple examples in the work group meeting where parents were fined. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that the truancy really did have some direct connection to special education services. And I think everyone in that room was sort of like, that's ridiculous, and we need to stop doing that. So that's a good place to hit the pause button and reevaluate what to do. So we feel comfortable that this is doable.
Thank you. Any other questions about the amendments?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, just to follow up, there was also some statement in the work group about districts feeling compelled to issue truancy notices under existing law, even if they would otherwise not. And so the work group participants, and I observed but did not participate, the group participants agreed that this would be a mechanism to tell schools that they were not forced to issue truancy citations but had discretion and should pause in the
Good.
Ongoing
Thank
IEP.
You. Okay. And I want to compliment the group. They worked long and hard and I think came out with a good product. So anyway, okay. Thank you very much. Representative Frederick.
Yes, Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the dash three amendments, right?
Two.
Dash two.
Dash two amendments.
I'm on the wrong bill.
Sorry. I move to adopt the dash two amendments to HB 2597, dated March 17th, 2015.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2597, dated March 17th, 2015. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Representative Frederick.
Chair Doherty, I move HB 2597 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves House Bill 2597 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none, will the clerk read the roll, please?
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Representative Peluso?
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye.
Call Hack.
Oh. Representative Hack?
Excused. Okay, with that, the motion passes, and I will ask Representative Buckley to carry this on the floor. Okay, with that, I close a work session on House Bill 2597 and open up a work session on House Bill 3039. And Richard, if you could read what
sure.
it is.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3039 allows district school boards to enter into a partnership for the purposes of acquiring, leasing, or improving real property for educational purposes. The committee has been asked to consider the dash one amendments, which replace language in the introduced bill relating to loans with a language that allows school boards to enter into agreements to take advantage of private partnerships in circumstances that are expected to reduce costs to the district for school facilities.
Okay, and we have Mr. Williams here to go through the amendments.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. If you'll remember, this was a bill at the request of the school district. We're working on a joint project at the Fabian Elementary School in conjunction with Concordia University to do a joint development, a co-location of their school event, et cetera. And it really highlighted for us what we saw as a little bit of a loophole in the statute as we look to find leveraged opportunities to get more funding into the project other than just the traditional bond funds, looking at the federal New Market Tax Credit program specifically, with which we didn't feel we had explicit authority to do so. So that's the bill you have before you. The language is essentially the same thing as the bill. We have bond counsel attorney talking to general counsel attorneys, and they had slight dispute about specific words. And I said, you guys figure out what are the words that we absolutely have to have, and then we'll do that. And so That's the amendment before you today. It essentially the same thing. Now, I know at the hearing there were some questions both about current use by educational entities in the state as well as a little bit of a schematic. You have in OLIS a two-page document that is still fairly lawyerly but does have a nice flowchart diagram, and I just want to give you a quick hit on that. First of all, the program has been used in the state by Lane Community College, Clatsop Community College, and Chemeketa Community College. So there is a precedent for use by public agencies. However, the ability for school districts to use this is statutorily called out in separate areas, and so that's what we're specifically calling for in this. In the document you have on page 2, you have a flow chart, and I really want to point out, just if you have it in front of you, you'll notice the flow chart starts at the top. There's something called leveraged lender. Mm-hmm. That is essentially the entity or groups of entities that would be supplying the capital for a project. So in this instance, it would be Portland Public Schools via our bond proceeds and Concordia University via other proceeds that they bring to the table, and even potentially other partners as we work to build that. Those funds then flow to what on this chart is shown as the investment fund. That's just the collection of all of those funds, okay? The bill is allowing that financial arrangement to take place right there in that first step. The rest of the flow chart is how New Market Tax Credits work now, but the bill applies to that one piece. Now, how you actually get the money is essentially that investment fund intermediary then applies for, receives the federal New Market Tax Credit, transfers the New Market Tax Credit to generally a financial institution like a bank, and then the bank provides capital then in return to the investment fund. That's your doubling effect of the funds, is bringing those funds from the financial institution into that joint entity that then goes through, and it has to be a qualified low-income entity that then builds the product and then contributes it back to the entity. So that's the general flow of process. The bill specifically deals with that one spot, allowing the school district to pool funds together in this investment fund structure with other entities.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Could you go over that again?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't need you to explain the whole thing over again. But as far as the access to those funds that are given by companies as a tax credit, are those available to any education entity across the state, or are they specifically a tax credit for, like, someone in Salem giving to a Salem school, et cetera?
So what the bill allows is for us to enter into that arrangement to then apply to get an allocation of the New Market Tax Credit. The tax credit then accrues to the corporation that's contributing the capital. The financial arrangement that applies and gets the tax credit is project specific. So in this instance, it's a joint project specific to the Fabian Concordia project. Now, the bill doesn't limit it simply to that arrangement. The bill would allow any school district, should they see the kind of valuable partnership to do this work in their area, would allow them to enter into that arrangement, apply for, get a New Market Tax Credit, and then leverage those dollars via financial institution. So it's not space limited in general. The specific project, the specific allocation of the tax credit, should one be received by that financial arrangement, would be project specific to that specific project.
Mm-hmm. As far as the, may I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
As far as the company who's getting the tax credit and the dollars going in, mm-hmm. are they, you know, is project specific from this end where the project's taking place? From the other end, the entity that's giving, he's just giving to the pool.
Right, correct. Thank you, Representative Barreto. I don't believe there's a place base for that corporation. My folks, both the councils and the project managers, indicate that it's likely going to be, say, a Wells Fargo or a U.S. bank. It's going to be a fairly large financial entity.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for the explanation. Okay, Representative Frederick.
Yes. Chair Doherty, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to HB 3039, dated April 1st, 2015.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves to adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 3039, dated April 1st, 2015. Is there any discussion?
Sure.
Okay, seeing none, is there any objection? Okay, seeing none, Amendments are adopted.
Chair Doherty, I move HB 3039 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves House Bill 3039 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk read the roll, please?
Representative Hack?
Excused.
Representative McClain?
Yes.
Representative Russo?
Yes.
Representative Reardon?
Yes.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Barreto?
You're not riding your motorcycle.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
He isn't now.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. Do we have a carrier? Representative Frederick, would you like to carry this bill?
I'd like to do that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. With that, that's it for business. All right, chair in the meeting. Have a good weekend. Have a good weekend. All right, chair in the meeting.